turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 108, and this is going to be a message that I delivered to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church. Today, regarding Judges chapter 2, dealing with the introduction to the cycles of disobedience and deliverance that God does throughout the book of Judges, a message that should speak to us in our present situation because of the status of the church and the way in which the church is in need of these things as well. And so it should be a good message for you. Take care, just a few minutes to be able to listen to that. But before we do that, I want to direct your attention to a couple of announcements. First of all, make sure that you are a registered user of the website. This enables you to receive updates through email anytime that there is a change to the website, so you can keep updated that way. Second of all, it helps you to be able to provide feedback through the comment section of each of the podcasts. I appreciate those of you who are doing that. And then also make sure that you are telling your friends and family about us through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Those of you who are liking our Facebook page, I appreciate you doing that. And then third up is make sure that you're visiting our affiliates. We have several affiliates that we are associated with that have something to do with building a legacy. And they are ones that I have agreed with in terms of what they offer and what they do and the way in which they do business. And the two up for today, the first one is Gurney's. And the reason I like Gurney's is because I have purchased different kinds of seeds and plants and trees from them over the years, and I appreciate their service. They have a 100% guarantee on their trees, so if something dies or it gets damaged in the mail or whatever it is, they'll replace it. And so that's a great service. They also have a wide range of different kinds of plants you can get from them and seeds, and they don't have the widest selection of organic, but they do have a good selection of exotics and some native plants, that kind of thing. So it's a great resource there. They also have some really excellent sales. So the coupon that I have, of course, through the website is $20 off, but you can access a lot more once you get online. But go through the website and check them out. Second of up is Amazon. You'll see now that I have an affiliate link there for Amazon. So anytime that you're wanting to search for something and buy something through Amazon, just go through the website. And it doesn't cost anything extra for you, but it does allow me to get a little bit of commissions on any sale that is made through the website, and this helps to support the show. Appreciate you doing that, and you can search for whatever it is in the center right column of the website. Appreciate that. And then finally, if you like the show, if you want to support the show, the best way to do that is become a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year. With that, you have exclusive access to our members-only web page that has discounts. We've got some more coming to various vendors. It also has some downloadable ebooks and some other material that you can download that should be a benefit to you, and all total is probably worth about $50 worth of value for only $30, and there's more to come still. Plus, you can support the show by doing that, and that's the best way, of course, to support the show, and I encourage you to do that. That takes care of the introductory business, so let's go ahead and listen to the message that I preached to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, today. Again, if you'd like to follow along, we're going to be in chapter 2 of the book of Judges, and most of us know that hunting season is over, or at least deer season is over. We tried to go out yesterday and get a couple of deer, but of course we didn't get one. We stirred one up in the woods, but by the time I got my safety off my gun and had the point of aim, it was gone. And so I missed it. Only Samuel was the only one to get a deer this year in our family. So seasons pass and new seasons arrive. Pretty soon we'll be out planting our gardens, and then the heat will come again. We'll be waiting for winter. And then fall will come and hunting season starts again. You see, life is full of cycles, isn't it? It seems like there's season after season, year after year. Can you believe it's already 2013? I mean, it flew by 2012.
Cycles just come and go. And we see all kinds of cycles. We live in a world full of cycles. We have hydrological cycles where the rain comes from the earth, gets into the groundwater, groundwater moves. My kids are just learning about that in science this week, about how the water permeates into the groundwater, and the groundwater then goes into the oceans, comes into the rain, clouds, and it just keeps cycling back and forth like that. There are all kinds of cycles and all kinds of seasons and all kinds of patterns that we see in the world. And you know, history repeats itself too. You've probably heard the saying before that history repeats itself, and the reason why we learn history is so that we do not repeat the things of the past. Well, that's not really accurate. The reason why we learn history is so that we know what things will repeat in the future, because history does repeat itself. And unfortunately, what we find in the book of Judges is we see some cycles that repeat themselves over and over and over again. And the cycle is this, basically, that the people of Israel go astray. God brings judgment upon them. They cry out for mercy. God brings a deliverance. They get delivered, and then they go back into sin. And we see that pattern over and over and over again. And in chapter 2 of the book of Judges, we see that being explained to us. We see the reasons why it's occurring, and we see some answers or some solutions to it. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at that today. But before we do that, we need to kind of catch up to where we are. Of course, we left in the book of Joshua with the walls of Jericho falling down and the people of Israel marching into Jericho and overthrowing that area. And that was the middle of Israel. And from that, then there was a division of the land. And Joshua, leading his army, was able to conquer the north and the south and was able to gain his campaign and overthrow much of the land of Israel as a result of that. And the rest of the book of Joshua deals with all of these conquests and all of these battles and wars that Joshua fought and that God fought through Joshua and the people of Israel. And then we get to chapter 2 of Judges. And it begins by saying this: "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you.'" One of the things that we see here in chapter 2 is God's faithfulness. And I want you to notice here what it says. He says that it is the angel of the Lord. Now, this is probably a theophany. It's what we refer to as theologians as theophanies, or even a Christophany. Theophany is a manifestation of God in the flesh. A Christophany is a pre-appearance of Christ before he actually was incarnate as Christ in the babe. And so whether this was a Christophany, meaning Christ, or a theophany of God, either one, it's very descriptive in the sense that it is God himself appearing to Joshua, or to the judges here, in expression of what is taking place. And so it says, "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you from Egypt and brought you up to the land which I swore to give to you.'" God is gracious to be able to lead his people out of the bondage that they were in Egypt and into the promised land. And so he is faithful in that regard. But even more so, it says, "I will never break my covenant with you." Even though we are unfaithful, God remains faithful. We're going to look more specifically at that theme here in just a moment. And then it says in verse 2, "And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this?" Now we need to back up to chapter 1, and beginning in verse 27, we see a description of the results of their disobedience. And in verse 27, it says, "However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land." So weren't they supposed to take out all of the land, all the people that inhabited Canaan? They were. And yet we see here in verse 27 that they had failed in that regard. And then verse 29, it says, "Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwell in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them." And then in verse 30, "Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Naholi, or Naholo. So the Canaanites dwell among them and were put to tribute." And then also in verse 31, "Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants." And then in verse 33, nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants. And then in verse 34, and the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down into the valley. And so all of these Israelite tribes are supposed to conquer the land of Israel. They failed. And as a result of that, they had these Canaanites living among them. And so when it says here that they were to drive out these people before them, but it says they did not obey the voice, why have you done this? Verse 3, it says, therefore I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. Verse 4, so it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voice and wept. They realized that the promise of a land of peace and prosperity that was promised to them under the covenant was not going to be there because they had disobeyed the covenant. Verse 5, and they called the name of that place Bochim, which means weeping. And they sacrificed there to the Lord. And when Joshua dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. But of course, they were possessing along with the Canaanites that were supposed to be destroyed. And then verses 7 through 10, we see the stage is set for this cycle of deliverance and disobedience that is contained in the Judges with the death of Joshua. So it says in verse 7, so the people have served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. So that is the people that were around during Joshua's day, the leaders of the land. As long as Joshua was there and the leaders of the land, all the people served the Lord. But then it says in verse 8, now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the borders of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaaz. And when all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. That sets the stage for this pattern of disobedience and deliverance. And then verses 11 through 19, what we see is this pattern being described. In verses 11 through 15, we have this pattern of disobedience. And it says in verse 11, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Now, this refrain of did evil in the sight of the Lord, this is repeated over and over again in the scriptures. And even in the book of Judges, in chapter 3, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 12, chapter 4, verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1, chapter 10, verse 6, chapter 13, verse 1. Over and over and over again, it's said of the people of Israel that they did evil in the sight of the Lord. And here it says that they served the Baals. And later it talks about the Ashtoreths. Now, Baal was the prince among the Canaanite gods. He was the god who was supposedly in charge of all the storms and all the rain and all the weather patterns and things like that. And he was the heir apparent to the throne of the kingdom. And, of course, the supreme god of the Canaanites was named El. And so this was El's son. Baal was El's son. And he was married to his sister, Ashtoreth. And Ashtoreth was the goddess of fertility. And as you might imagine, to worship Baal and to worship the Ashtoreths, there was all kinds of licentiousness and immorality that was conducted in the process of worshiping these gods. And yet these Israelites who remained in the land were tempted to worship like the people were worshiping among the Canaanites. And as a result of that, they became a snare. So we see in verses 16 through 19, God's deliverance. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges. So I love those words, nevertheless. You know, they're contracting words where they combine sentences, and yet sometimes there's so much power in that. So we see this disobedience among the people of Israel. Had they gone astray, they served the Baals and they served the Ashtoreths. And by the way, the reason why those are plural, Baals and Ashtoreths, is because each little village had their own specific way of worshiping God. And so they became kind of almost known as multiple gods within that realm of Baal and Ashtoreth. That's why they're always in the plural. But so they had gone astray and worshiped these gods. And then it says in verse 16, nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods. In the scriptures, we always see this symbolism being explained about the relationship between a husband and a wife and how sacred that is. And when that is disregarded and the harlot comes in, of course, it is a devastation. And God speaks of that same relationship in a spiritual sense with his people, where he is to be married to his people, and yet they continually go astray like a harlot goes astray and has many different companions. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. In verse 18, and when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. Kind of reminds us of the Exodus. Remember in the Exodus when they were crying and petitioning the Lord, and God heard their cries when they were in slavery in Egypt. And then in verse 19 it says, it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods. So you see this pattern? They cry out asking God for mercy. He shows mercy, raises up a judge. The judge delivers them. As soon as the judge dies, they go back to worship Baals and Ashtoreths. Continuing in verse 19, it says, they did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn way. And then verse 20 through 23, we see the purpose behind all of this. Then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. By the way, I love the word picture that is used in the word anger in Hebrew. The word anger in Hebrew actually means nostrils. And you think, nostrils and anger, how in the world does those two words actually mean the same thing? Well, they actually use it descriptive of what a bull does when it gets angry. I don't know if I've never been in a bullfight, thank the Lord. And probably most of you have never been in one either. But maybe you've been around a bull when it's angry. And what does a bull do when it's angry? Its nostrils flare, right? And start kicking the ground, right? That's the idea of anger. That's the word picture that's given to us in anger. So if you were actually reading the Hebrew, what it would say here is it says that the Lord was hot with a nose. But it really means the Lord was hot with anger. His nostrils were flared. And why was he so angry at the circumstances? Because time and time again, he showed mercy, and time again, the people of Israel went astray. It says, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Joshua. So in other words, these remnants of the Canaanites were left in the land of Israel to test Israel to see whether or not they were going to worship the Baals or whether they were going to worship the true God. And he did that as a way to signify whether they were going to keep the covenant. So what can we learn from this by way of principle? What are some things that we can glean from the scriptures here regarding our own life and the principles as it relates to the Lord? Well, number one is, God is faithful to keep his covenant over and over and over again. He was faithful to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt into the promised land. He delivered them. And it's interesting to note that he required the law, of course, after deliverance. It wasn't the law first and then deliverance. It was deliverance first, grace first, and then the law. And he was faithful to do that. He was faithful to never break his covenant, it says in verse 1. He is faithful in raising up rescuers time and time again as the people cry out to him. He raises up another deliverer, and we're going to look at a couple of those as examples in the book of Judges in the upcoming weeks. He was faithful in raising up these rescuers. He was faithful in heeding by mercy their cries. He was faithful to move to anger, to bring judgment upon them when they disobeyed. And he was faithful to test Israel to see whether or not they were faithful to the covenant. Deuteronomy chapter 7 verse 9 says, therefore know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. 1,000 generations, that's a long time. And of course, that's just symbolic language. The idea behind it is that God keeps his faithfulness to his covenant always. He never fails. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 13 says, if we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. You see, God is true in and of himself. When he promises something, it cannot be taken away because that would be a denial of his whole character. And so he is faithful always to keep his covenant. You know, it's not three strikes and you're out. Sometimes in our culture, we have this policy of three strikes and you're out. Of course, we know that in baseball, right? Three strikes and you're out. But even when it comes to correction and discipline, it's three strikes and you're out. I remember back, my fifth grade year of elementary school was not a good year. And I don't know what it was about my fifth grade year. Fourth grade, good. Sixth grade, good. Fifth grade, not so good. And we had this policy in our elementary school that if you acted out in class or did something wrong, I was always disciplined for talking too much in class. Can you believe that a future preacher would be disciplined for talking too much in class? And yet, indeed, I was. And so the first infraction of some kind of thing like that, they would write your name on the board. Y'all remember this? Did they do this in your school? Write your name on the board, right? After that, they put a check mark next to it, right? If you did it again, another check mark. That second check mark after your name, what does that mean? That means detention, right? Usually for me, it meant inside writing sentences, I will not talk in class during recess. Hated that. Three strikes and you're out. You know, with God, it's not that way. Aren't you glad that with God, it's not three strikes and you're out? In fact, in the book of Luke, he says, how many times should we forgive our brothers? 70 times seven. Now, how can he say that? He can say that because that's what he does with us. Time and time, every day, we sin against God. And yet, when we cry out to him, he has mercy on us. And every day, he forgives us. That's the kind of faithfulness that God has with us. There's two aspects of his faithfulness here that we should be understanding of. And the one is that God is faithful. His faithfulness is perfect. In other words, we put our faith in a lot of things in this culture, in this world, in our lives. There's a lot of things that we place our faith in, whether it be the pews that we're sitting in. We're putting faith that we're going to be held up in those pews. We put faith in various people. We get married with the understanding that it's going to be forever, right? And yet, sometimes that doesn't happen, does it? Sometimes things break. Sometimes relationships fall apart. Sometimes contracts are broken. You ever had somebody promise, oh yeah, I'll be there at 8 o'clock in the morning? And then about 12 o'clock they call and say, yeah, I wasn't able to get to you today. Right? It's a verbal contract of some kind, not broken. People just don't keep their word. How many promises have not been kept? How many promises have we promised our children? Yeah, I'll do that in just a minute. And then we forget. Right? But God's not that way. God is faithful to his covenant always. He always keeps his word. He is always faithful. Never does he forget. Never does he negate. But secondly, it also teaches us that God's faithfulness is persistent. You can call out to God for deliverance today, tomorrow, the next day, next week, next month. It doesn't matter what age you are. It doesn't matter how many times you've sinned. I know there's probably some of you here probably today, or maybe you've experienced this in the past, or you will definitely experience it in the future, where you've sinned again. And you think to yourself, how in the world can God forgive me again? I did the same thing I did yesterday. I said I wasn't going to do. And I did it again, and again, and again, and again. And yet God's faithfulness is sufficient enough that he's able to give mercy to us again, and again, and again. We see that exemplified here with his faithfulness to the people of Israel. But secondly, we also see another principle here, and that is that God's people must be separate from the world. God's people must be separate from the world. Look with me in verse 2. It says, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Now, why was it that he was instructing the people of Israel to go into the land and to destroy all the Canaanites and all that they had? so that they might not be tempted to become a part of the Canaanite culture. They were not to assimilate with them, but instead they were supposed to be separate. And in verses 11 through 15, we read this, "Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger." You hear that? They started following all the ways of all the people all around them. When they were supposed to go in the land and be separate, they were supposed to be a distinct people, they were supposed to be a lighthouse, they were supposed to be so different that the other nations around them were to be gathered to the Lord as a result of their witness. But instead, what they do, they went into the promised land and they became like the people around them. They assimilated. And the idea is that God wants us to be different. He wants to be separate from the world. Listen to what it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 and following. It says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? For what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part was a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will rescue you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty." See, oil and water does not mix. And that is the way it is supposed to be with Christians. Now, that doesn't mean that we're supposed to be taken completely out of the world. Now, throughout history, the church has responded to the separateness of the world in different ways. There's been monasteries where people have gone and they've totally distanced themselves from the world and separated themselves physically and completely from the world and said, we're going to go to the monastery so that we can separate ourselves from the world. And then on the other extreme, there's been the people who said, we're going to embrace everything the world embraces. And neither one is the correct response. We are to live in the world, but not of the world. We're to be separate, and yet dwelling in. The Israelites were supposed to live in the land of Israel, or the land of the Canaanites, but not be like the Canaanites. Christians, we are to live in the world, but not be like the world. I love the smell of fresh Play-Doh. I know it sounds strange, okay? But when the kids get new Play-Doh, I think Mary got some Play-Doh for Christmas, and when she opened it, I went over there. I don't know what it is. Call me a Play-Doh sniffer, okay? But I like Play-Doh. I don't know what it is. I like the smell of it. I like the looks of it. I like the feel of fresh Play-Doh. You know, when it first comes out of that container, you open it, and it's nice and soft and mushy, you know, and it's just real pliable, and it smells good. And it's all pure, especially like the white kind. You can get the white kind. It's really great, right? But then what happens over time? The kids begin to play with it, and they mix the red with the white. And it becomes kind of a pinkish color. And then they mix the blue with that. And it becomes kind of like a grayish, yucky color, right? And eventually all the colors are mixed together and you have this ball. And not only that, but they forget to put it back in the container. And it gets all hard and crusty. And pretty soon you have this blackish, brown blob of crust. Well, that's what happens with us when we assimilate with the world. God works to try to sanctify us, to make us that pure white lamp that lights up the world. And then we take a little bit of the world here, and a little bit of the world here, and a little bit of the world over here, and a little bit of... And pretty soon we're this blackish brown blob of yuck. No, we need to be separate from the world. We need to be clean. Have you become assimilated with the world? You know, this has implications when it comes to our relationships. Young people, listen to me. It has to deal with who you spend time with, who you marry. Bible's very clear. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. You know, I remember in college, some of my buddies had the philosophy, date them and convert them. No. That's not the philosophy of the scriptures. It's supposed to be unequally yoked. And then it says, or that we also has ramifications when it comes to our fashions and our dress. My wife gets so frustrated when she tries to go shopping for the kids, especially Mary. there's nothing appropriate out there. Pretty much have to make your own clothes, or you know, find some vintage clothes or something like that, because there's hardly anything that's appropriate anymore. Because if we take on the ways of the world, we'll look like the ways of the world, and you don't want to do that. It has to do with the cultural aspects that we embrace. What kinds of things do we participate in as a culture? Entertainment, music, and things that we do for leisure. It has to do with the way in which we educate our children. Are we going to educate the way the world, Canaanites, educated their children? Or are we going to educate the world, or educate our children the way that God wants us to educate our children? And then it has to do with the way in which we worship God. Can you believe the people of Israel assimilated so much with the Canaanite religions that eventually they started offering their children to the fire in sacrifice of the god Marduk? Can you believe it? And yet that's what happens when we become part of the world. We become so accustomed to doing the things that the way the world does that we totally lose sight of what God has planned for us in our worship of Him. And so God's people must be separate from the world. But thirdly, God's people must have a multi-generational or a generational discipleship. We must have generational discipleship. Look with me in verse 7 and then verse 10. These are some of the saddest verses in all of Scripture. It says, "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel." Then skip down to verse 10. "When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel." Why? Why had they not known? Why did they not know the God who had just delivered them, who had done all these things? Can you imagine? This is the God who delivered these people out of Israel, out of Egypt. He had given them all the food in the wilderness, provided them with manna from heaven, provided them with food to eat and water to drink from the rocks. And he provided them with deliverance from Jericho and all these other places. He did all these wonderful things. And yet, because this generation failed to teach this generation knew not God. Can you believe it? It's horrendous. What a tragedy that one generation does not follow the generation that follows, that comes before it. Now, before we criticize the Israelites too heavily, let's consider our own situation. There was a study done on Southern Baptist churches and why it is in most Southern Baptist churches there's a generation missing. And they tried to come up with some reasons for it, and they began to investigate it. And what they found, statistically, was that 4 out of 5 young people, by the time they reach college, had denied the faith. 4 out of 5 have said, "I'm not going that way anymore. I'm going to do something else." 70% that grew up in evangelical churches. Evangelical churches are those who believe the gospel. 70% of those who raised up in evangelical churches, by the time they get to college, say, "See ya. I don't want that a part of my life anymore." It says the greatest risk of those who attended church regularly, but there was a disconnect between what they taught in church and the way in which life was lived outside the church. In other words, they compartmentalized their faith. Faith was for something you did in church. Life was for something you did outside of church. That's what they found. And just in case that was an exclusive study, there was another study done by Ken Ham and Britt Beamer, his book Already Gone. And of that, they surveyed and investigated over 1,020-somethings, people who had been through the high school years and all that, raised up in church. These are people who were raised up in Sunday school class, raised up in the churches, went to church every Sunday with their parents. And what did it find? It found that they had actually denied the faith back in elementary school. And they were just going through the forms and the motions through high school, middle school. So when they finally got off on their own, they didn't think twice about going a different way. And here's the one that just breaks my heart. Less than 10% of evangelical parents. Again, evangelical parents are the parents that believe the gospel, right? 10% of evangelical parents discuss matters of faith in the home. Proverbs 22, verse 6 says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. There's a beautiful picture that's given to us in this, and I've communicated this before to the church, but just in case we've forgotten what it is, the word train up a child here, it actually literally means touch the palate of the child. And the description that is given of that is what parents would do with their children in Hebrew culture. And because they didn't have, you know, food processors and couldn't go down to Food Lion or Walmart and buy baby food cans with, you know, processed food and things like that, what the moms and dads would do is they would take a piece of lamb, or they'd take a piece of bread that they were eating, or whatever it was at the time that they were eating, and they would chew it up to where it's really gummy, and I don't, it's kind of gross, but they would chew it all up, make it so that it's very palatable, and they would take it out of their mouth, and then they would place it upon the palate of their child. So that the child then would be able to have the same tastes as the parents. So the parents would be eating this lamb, and they'd say, oh man, this is good lamb. And they'd chew it all, and then they'd take it and they'd put it on the child's palate, and the child would be able to taste that lamb. And by doing that, that child would be raised up with good nutrition. They'd be able to raise up with the same tastes and desires that their parents had of that same food. And that's the picture that's given here where it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. We as parents have the responsibility to touch the palate of our children with the good news of the gospel. To touch the palate of our children with the truth of his grace and of his mercy. So that as they are raised up, they will have the tastes for God that we ourselves have. Unfortunately, the people of Israel didn't do that. They missed it. I don't know what happened, why they got so consumed. Maybe they were too busy fighting battles to teach their children. We can't let that happen to us. We must not let it be said of our generation what was said of the generation of the judges, that a generation arose that did not know God or the works that he did. So what are we doing to train our children in faith? I believe it involves three elements. You might want to jot these down. First of all, it involves an integration of faith and life. Faith is not something that we do here in church. Faith is something we live. Faith is something we experience every day. It impacts every aspect of our life. It impacts what we watch on TV, what we read, how we do everything. Our faith should involve in that. And so it's an integration of faith and life. Secondly, there must be Bible and theology training in the home. One day a week in front of a pastor, or 2 hours a week in front of a pastor or a Sunday school teacher, is not enough to train our children. We have to do it at home. We have to be able to teach and train our children up in the home in theology and Bible. And then thirdly, and maybe most importantly, we need to exemplify it for our children. They need to be able to see us in love with the Lord. They need to be able to see us following after him. They need to be able to see us searching the scriptures for solutions and answers to the problems that we have, so that they can see our lives and have that as an example. I believe that there may be harder times coming in the future of our nation. I don't think it's real difficult to read the news and to see the state of our financial state of our nation, or the moral state of our nation, or the state of our church across the nation, to see that harder times are probably in store for us as a nation. Because of this, I believe that, I think that this is a result of our nation leaving the faith, deciding to go the way of the Canaanites, rather than go the way of the Lord. And God is going to bring judgment upon us as a result of that. I believe that. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know whether it's going to be a gradual thing, or it's going to be an immediate thing, or how long it's going to take. But I really believe that's in store for us. Unless we do three things in the church. Unless we call out to God, beg for his mercy, claim his faithfulness. Secondly, lest we repent of our assimilation. Turn away from the culture of the world and say, I'm not going to go that way. I'm going to go the way of the Bible. And then thirdly, we train up the next generation to know and love the Lord. That's the only way it's going to turn around. It's not going to be electing politicians. You know how much I love that. It's not going to be by enforcement of certain laws. Nope. It's going to be by calling out to God. It's going to be by repenting. And it's going to be teaching and training the next generation. That's what we can learn from this chapter.
Time after time is a legacy with nothing to share.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your life?